Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this tenure information session for the 2012-13 tenure year. My name is Stephen Stropel. I'm the Secretary General, and you may well wonder what role the Secretary General has or the Secretariat. So just briefly, we do have significant responsibility for the tenure process. And with the understanding that that we play a neutral role and have objectivity to ensure that the process unfolds as it should. What that really means in practice is that we do quite a lot of coordination between you, our candidates for tenure, and the various tenure committees, the departmental and university tenure committees. We also take care of a lot of communication, the compilation and distribution of documents. And on the communication front particularly, with a very small exception, our office is the only office that is authorized to communicate with the external evaluators. So throughout the process, from time to time, you may hear from anyone in the Secretariat, and in particular I'd like to introduce Bonnie Bornstein, who is the person in the Secretariat who will play the lead role in coordinating the process in the coming year. This information session is certainly for any candidates who will be coming forward in the next cohort. That'll be the 2013-14 cohort, for anyone who is in the process this year, as well as any members of departmental university tenure committees, and essentially anyone else who's interested in understanding how the process works. So there's no intent to exclude anyone. Today's presentations, as you will see from the agenda, or I guess, involves four speakers, our principal, Professor Heather Monroe Bloom, Provo, Professor Anthony Massey, our Associate Provo of, I can never remember this, Policies and Equity, Professor Lydia White, and our Director of Teaching and Learning Services, Professor Cynthia Weston. And we do have a very full agenda for the time that is allotted. We have a very hard stop time of 12:20 at the latest. I know the session was scheduled to end at 12 o'clock, and hopefully we'll be able to do that. But in the event that there are questions and we do go over, we do have a hard stop time because there's a class in this room at 12:30. Just three small points. One, you should have received on your way in two documents. One, sort of a yellow piece of paper, is the timetable of critical dates that are relevant to candidates. It's certainly not all of the dates, and not all of the dates that, for instance, would be relevant to chairs of departmental and university tenure committees, but for the candidates, this contains the important dates for you. Secondly, you would have received guidelines for submission of tenure documents, electronic submission. In effect, all documents should be submitted, ideally in electronic form. We do make provision for the submission of things like books, which may not be available in except in hard copy form. But just so you understand, that the electronic format enables the distribution of those documents in a much more time efficient manner, and to the extent that we have any hard copy materials, it's just going to take longer to distribute them to committees and to external evaluators, and so it could result in some extra time where it would be better, in fact, if the external evaluators had the materials earlier to give them an adequate opportunity to do their part of the process. The third thing is that this session is being live streamed, and there are, we know, a number of people watching from home or from their offices, and because of the technology in the room, in order for questions to be heard by all of those who may be watching from afar, it is important that you use the microphones on either side to ask your questions. So I would ask, when we do get to, whenever any of you would like to ask a question, if you could just come to the microphone. And other than that, I would just let you know that there will be another tenure information session early in the new year on the McDonald campus, should you wish to have another opportunity. But I should also point out that the live streaming of today's session will be archived and will be available for viewing subsequently. So with that, I'd like to call on our principal, Professor Heather Monroe Bloom, to start this morning off.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Bonjour, bienvenue. Welcome, everybody. Can I just ask, so I know who we're speaking to, how many of you are coming up for tenure review? Hands high. How many, as you come in, would you, let's try this one more time. So we've got a group coming in right now. Let's give it a second. Okay, so let's try that again with everybody entering the room as well. How many of you are coming up for tenure review? How many of you are here because you're tenured and involved in the tenure process for colleagues? How many of you are here in a different role? A lot. So what just as an example, what's your interest in the session? Yeah, no, right behind you. Yeah. Pardon me? Okay, so your support to the dossier, too. So I'd put you in the first group. So, thank you for coming out. And I know my colleague, Tony Massey, will say the same thing. Clearly, the tenure process is an extraordinarily important process. And as long ago as it may have happened for some of us, we remember well the anxiety and tension and sense of uncertainty that accompanies going through this process. And so please take very seriously what the Secretary General said about, first of all, the information. If you feel you don't understand things that you need to understand, come back to us and let us help you with that. And two, let me just say, as principal of McGill, you know, over the last decade or so, we've recruited over 1,000 new tenure stream professors to McGill from all around the world. That is over half of the tenured professoriate of McGill. And to give you just a comparison, if you'd come in 1990, less than 10% of the professoriate would have been new in the prior decade. So this is a massive renewal. It's what we call it, renewal of the professoriate. And of course, we have many colleagues who have been here as well, longstanding. When we talk about tenure and the importance of tenure, it reflects the fact that a tenured professoriate have a special position within the university. You have special employee status. We benchmark compensation for our tenure stream professors nationally and internationally against your discipline. All other employee groups are benchmarked in the local Montreal context, and looking for high quality in every employee group, but understanding that the reputation and success, the ability of McGill to contribute locally, domestically, and internationally through the three major categories of activity, research, teaching, and service, that professors perform is, at the end of the day, what McGill is known for, how we're resourced, and then in this kind of iterative loop, what we're able to do vis-a-vis the mission that we have, which is a mission as a research-intensive university committed to high-quality teaching, the interaction of teaching and research and scholarship that's measured against the highest international standards. That's a big load that you bear and that we bear with you. And we are, in that regard, as committed to your professional development and success as we are to ensuring that you understand what your responsibilities are here. The two go hand in hand. You need to be supported fully to be successful in this environment. It's demanding. It's also deeply rewarding, deeply rewarding. And so I want to start by saying we are committed to your success. Part of the tenure process is finding out, is the fit right? That's partly your decision and partly the decision of the tenure process. But we want every one of you to be successful in doing what you do here and to be able to contribute fully. Tenure is not, and this is probably timely, we've just had a conference led by the provost and his team on academic freedom. We've had a lot of debate in Quebec and Canada and internationally about freedom of speech and other issues. Tenure, the notion of tenure, which is interestingly with the public, every element of the public, what I have to defend most about a university, because the average smart person has no idea why tenure is important. Tenure is important in guaranteeing you, and therefore the university, freedom to pursue ideas, scholarship, teaching, consistent with your expertise, independent of what the norms and values and prohibitions that may exist in society might say. So it's really to guarantee your freedom to do what you're here to do. And so in exchange for the extraordinary benefits that come with being a tenured professor come the responsibilities that we all know well. But it's a very precious right and freedom, and one that we are absolutely committed at all times to protecting, because McGill can't be McGill without academic freedom, along with our mission of producing teaching, scholarship, and research at the highest international standards. The two go hand in hand. And we'd like to think of universities as being leaders and paving the way in society and in civil society, and that's a key component of that. You'll hear more in this session about what teaching, research, and service mean, and how these are measured, how we understand them, what the institutional standards are, and how those get expressed at the local level of disciplines or interdisciplinary fields. But I guess I want to stress, just as a last message here, and I'm happy to take questions or comments, that the success of our students is also very, very important. By any measure you can look at, we have an extraordinary group of students who come to McGill, and they come from Quebec, from every region of Canada, and from over 160 countries around the world. And it is our view that they ought to benefit from the great research and scholarly enterprise that you support, in addition to whatever they do to advance their own learning. And so we put a premium on looking at how you innovate in your teaching, how current you are in your teaching, and the extent to which you bring your research or scholarship into play in engaging with students in a progressive way. So I'm saying this up front because the question that I think Tony and I are most often asked is, does teaching actually really count in the tenure process, or is it at the end of the day just the number of publications you have on which you're measured? And of course, the assessment of scholarship and research go far beyond the publications that you have as well. So I want to thank you for choosing McGill and for being here. The university is you, and you are the university. And please use this session, but not only this session, which, as the Secretary General said, is time limited, but all other processes available, to make sure you're equipped, fully understanding what the process is expecting of you, and able to participate in it, fully putting your best foot forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I'd like to talk to you a bit today of Tony Massey, the provost of the university, and I'd like to talk a bit about the role of tenure, its rationale, the privileges that go along with it, your responsibilities should you achieve it, what are the components of the process. Lydia White will, it's really, I think of this as the Lydia White show, because it's really about all of the procedures that now, at this stage, for those of you going through the tenure process, you have to really think carefully about to make sure that you've compiled your dossier in an appropriate way. But the tenure system that we have at McGill does have a number of important procedural things, but I want to talk a little bit more about the substantive things. There's a really strong rationale for tenure, which the principal alluded to in her remarks. And that is, tenure is necessary to guarantee that the institution and the individual are free to pursue scholarship, to teach, and to provide service in the way in which they're competent to do so in a society that may not always be as accommodating as it should be to those pursuits. So we really want to make sure that you understand that there are in place at the university fair and proper procedures for the evaluation of our academic staff who are on a tenure track, and it continues after you're tenured, and that the relevant criteria are the three that the principal indicated. And they're part of McGill's mission. McGill is a research-intensive university, and so your pursuits, your scholarly pursuits and your research are a fundamental component of compiling a dossier for consideration for tenure. But McGill is a university, not just a research institute, and therefore teaching and the transmission of that knowledge is extremely important. And the third thing is that McGill holds itself to extremely high standards on both of those dimensions, international standards of excellence, but we're also an institution that is imbued with a strong sense of public purpose and therefore service to the scholarly community. Service to the scholarly community, service to the department, the faculty, and the university community, and service to the local and national and international communities also form part of what has to be a consideration for achieving tenure. Now, I'm going to say something here which may seem really strange to you, which is to reverse the whole thing and say, once you've gotten tenure, the procedures in place at the university have to be such that you can't lose it except under extraordinary circumstances. So once you've been given the privilege of tenure, you then have lots of leeway to pursue your scholarly pursuits, to make sure that you're teaching in a way that's appropriate and to provide that service. But there can be instances in which you could lose tenure, but they're extraordinary. The first is for cause. And that could be caused in a variety of different ways. Fraud, being charged with a criminal offense, a variety of other issues that could come up that would mean your behavior is inappropriate and judged to be so by your peers. Another thing is, however, you can't lose that tenure except if there's a fair process and proper procedures. And we want to make sure you understand these procedures follow you through the course of being on a tenure track to tenure and then afterwards. And the last reason would be under extreme financial exigency where tenure could also be denied. Tenure comes with enormous privileges. Again, the principal pointed them out, academic freedom. It also gives you a certain degree of economic security. It doesn't mean that you have all of the economic luxury that most of us would like to enjoy. But it does mean that your salary is determined by your performance of the duties that are part of your academic life. And you also have the right to be involved much more fully, once you've been tenured, in the university's life and decision making. The principal also pointed out that we want you to be successful. And that means we have to give you the tools as an institutional support to allow that to happen. Now, that doesn't mean that the university has to support with all the resources that are available your research. We want to put you in a position where you can compete for peer-reviewed grants or obtain contracts or in some other way pursue your scholarly activities. But we have to make sure that the institution is supportive of those things, although it can't provide direct support for all of your research activities. It has to make it possible for you to be able to do that. If you have privileges, you also have responsibilities. And the responsibilities, and the principal pointed this out as well, are professionalism. You have to act in a professional way. And that's professorial professionalism as well as professionalism in your discipline. That means being aware of what your status as a professor really means. It does mean you have to make contributions to instruction. Some of you may be in programs that only have graduate students, in which case your contributions to undergraduate education would be different. Some of you may not have access to graduate students in the same way that others do. Therefore, your contributions will be primarily at the undergraduate level, even though you'll be pursuing research on your own or in a team. So we want to make sure that you understand the obligations that go along with being professional as a professor, professional in your discipline, teaching in whatever way you can, transmitting the knowledge that you are generating to another generation of individuals, and that you provide service in some way to one of those communities I mentioned earlier. We want to make sure that your scholarship, research, and other contributions, the three academic duties that are assessed for tenure, also support McGill's mission. Again, the principal and I have indicated to you, it's research intensity, student-centeredness through our educational programs, highest international standards of excellence, and a sense of public purpose. We've got to have all of those things in your dossier. But there's something else. When you receive tenure, the regulations for both the employment of librarian and academic staff indicate very clearly that a member of the academic staff who is granted tenure shall maintain the high standards for which it was granted. So tenure isn't the end of your academic pursuits, it's the beginning. Throughout the rest of your career, you'll be expected to perform at least at the levels for which tenure was granted. So it's a high bar that we have there. The components of our tenure process at McGill are also extremely important. There's a first-line quality assurance measure, and that's the hiring process. All of you who are here on a tenure track were part of a big competition to fill the position that you presently have. And a solid hiring process is fundamental to a good tenure process. And in the middle, between the time you were hired and the time you're now coming up for tenure, is an important reappointment process. That's the front line in our tenure decisions. And many people who we bring in don't arrive at the position in which you find yourselves now. People make a decision at the reappointment stage that this is not, again, as the principal pointed out, the best fit for them or for the institution, and they make alternative arrangements to pursue the rest of their careers elsewhere or in a different way. So we have to have good hiring and good reappointment procedures. There also is a set of expectations that each of you should have already undertaken with the chairs of your department. What are your teaching duties? What are the expectations? What would a decent, exceptional, actually, research record look like in your field? What can you already be doing in terms of service to the community for ensuring that you've had an opportunity to pursue all three areas? These criteria are sent to all of you sometime after you've been appointed, and they're written. There is a timetable, and there's written criteria for tenure that's available in the regulations. And in addition, there are several layers of internal review. Again, you can't have a healthy tenure system unless you have a sound evaluation of individuals all through their career leading up to tenure. And as I just pointed out in the regulations, it pursues after you've achieved tenure. So we need a strong system of evaluation. Sound evaluations are the fairest and most defensible outcomes for a tenure decision. Not all tenure decisions are positive. But by the time you've gotten to this point in your careers, you know what you've achieved, and you have now to produce a dossier that puts that into clear evidence of your accomplishments. We want to make sure that there's an opportunity all through your careers, in particular up on the tenure track, for having a constructive dialogue. And as I said, we have processes at McGill that start at the departmental level, so there's a departmental tenure committee. And we always urge departmental tenure committees never to pass on difficult decisions to a higher level, because it's really not fair to you, it's not fair to the department, and it's not fair to the university. So we expect the chairs who are in this room to be able to take difficult decisions if they have to do so. We also expect that once a department has made a judgment, there has to be a one-up review of that in terms of the faculty's criteria for tenure. So there are a departmental tenure committee, then there's a faculty tenure committee, a university tenure committee that's usually chaired by the dean or delegate. So your departmental review, a faculty review. But then, after those two levels of review, the dossier comes to the principal's office and to the provost's office, where we review each and every one of the dossiers that's been sent forward. And as the principal said, in the last decade, this has been an enormous amount of work, because we've gone from reviewing 15 or 20 dossiers a year to reviewing 80 to 100 dossiers a year. So we actually appreciate the fact that they're now coming in, as Stephen Stropel pointed out, in electronic format, because before, our offices were literally boxes of material that we had to go through and review, and now we can do it in a much more efficient manner. So it is important to have that work done appropriately and electronically. When those three reviews have gone through, if everything is positive, there is no need for an appeal, and it is submitted to the Board of Governors for final approval. But if there are conflicts between a departmental tenure review, a university tenure review, or the assessment of the principal and myself with regard to a dossier, and we reject tenure, it's not over. There is an appeal committee process at McGill. It's fairly unusual to have one, but we have one. So that means that there are four different levels of opportunity in the case in which a review is negative, and three if in case in which it's positive. These are, and the principal said this in her remarks, these are the most important decisions that a university makes. Granting tenure is about defining the faculty and the library of this university. And when a tenured professor or a librarian does his or her job, they're helping to define the university. So these are the most important decisions that we make, and that's why we spend so much time on them. We worry about getting tenure, and then once we've gotten tenure, your role institutionally is to make sure that the people who come after you actually are better than you are. Right? We want to ratchet up our expectations about performance. So each tenure cohort that goes through should clearly be better than the ones that came before it, and it's your job to make sure that that happens. There are at least three questions that a tenure committee and you as individuals should be asking. Are you convinced, based on the criteria that have been available to you in the preparation of your dossier, that your teaching, your research and scholarship, and your service reflect appropriately the established criteria? You have to be willing to ask yourself that question. Many people, as I said before, come to the midterm reappointment and realize that's not the right thing. Other people come later to that decision and decide to withdraw from the tenure process because they haven't met the established criteria on the three academic duties. And you have to think about it not only in terms of your department, but also your faculty or the library as a whole and the university. When we look at it, we also want to know, is the work you've produced in those three areas representative of McGill's high standards, the highest international standards of excellence? We are, a university that prides itself on being able to be among the world's leading research-intensive universities with a purpose of educating students. So you've got to have those criteria clear. And will this decision, for you as an individual and the university as a whole, really be good for the department, the faculty or library, or the university? We are striving for excellence, and there's always room for improvement in this tenure process. And every year, I've been the provost for 7 years, and every year we've seen things that we need to improve in processes or procedures, and sometimes, as then Lydia White may talk about some of these, we also may need to change some of the policy dimensions of what we're doing. Don't be shy about recommending changes that would make the process more meaningful to you without just giving you tenure the first day you arrive. Let's be clear about that. But would help you to help us to make a better tenure decision. We're continually striving to strengthen the evaluation procedures and the nature of the deliberations at every stage. So an example, recently we've changed the rules regarding external letters of reference so that now both the Departmental Tenure Committee and the University Tenure Committee see those letters. Before it was a series, it was in sequence rather than parallel, and the letters were only available at the level of the University Tenure Committee. Now we've made a change to make it more appropriate for taking decisions at the departmental level. There can be, and probably are, other areas where suggestions could be useful for us to make things better. This is an important process for us. We really appreciate the fact that you're even letting us consider your tenure dossier, and we hope that the process will be run smoothly for you, and Lydia White will, I'm sure, be able to answer most of the questions that you have. But the principal and I will be here in case there are other questions. I'll stop there, and I'll take questions if you have any. If not, Lydia White.
So I'm going to take you in a bit more detail through the process and the procedures that are involved. While the focus is on next year's tenure cohort, the things that I'm going to say apply to any of you who are coming several years in advance of your year of tenure consideration. So basically, I just said that. I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that much of what I'm going to say is contained within two sets of regulations, the regulations relating to the employment of tenure track and tenured academic staff, and the regulations relating to the employment of librarian staff. Both of these are available from the Secretariat. But for those of you in the professoriat, these regulations relating to the employment of tenure track and tenured academic staff are new. They were approved earlier this year. And they, as far as tenure is concerned and several other things, replace the previous regulations, which were called regulations relating to the employment of academic staff. So it's important, although the changes relating to tenure are not major, there are some, and it's very important that you consult the relevant set of regulations as you work out what aspects of the process apply to you. So first of all, just to remind you that there is a mandatory year of tenure consideration, which varies depending on your rank. So assistant professors must be considered not later than their sixth year, and assistant librarians, associate professors and librarians in their fifth year, and full professors and librarians in their fourth year. But you can, of course, be considered for early tenure consideration, in which case, if you're at the assistant level, as of your third year, you can request early tenure consideration. Your chair can suggest that you think about it earlier than that. And for associate and full professors and librarians, early tenure consideration can be requested in any year. In other words, you don't have to wait till your mandatory year. I'll also briefly mention that there are certain circumstances in which you can ask for, or in fact elect, for your year of tenure consideration to be delayed. And these all relate to cases where you've had an authorized leave, such as a maternity leave, a leave of absence, a disability leave, of longer than 3 months and happening prior to the year of consideration. In those cases, you may elect to defer, but you don't have to elect. And for those of you that take leaves, I would strongly recommend that you don't make that decision too early. In fact, you don't have to make the decision until June 1st of the year in which you would normally be your normal mandatory year of tenure consideration. And you're allowed only two such deferrals. You're allowed two such elections during your years as on tenure track. Now, this has already been mentioned by both the principal and the provost. There are certain academic duties which form the criteria for tenure decisions. So the academic duties in question are teaching, ranging over undergraduate and graduate courses, supervision of students and the like. Research and related scholarly activities and professional activities. And then, now I'm here not going to use the word service, although everybody calls it service, but if you look in the regulations, the word service does not occur. Rather, it's other contributions to the university and scholarly communities. The shorthand is service. A lot of people suggest this is an inappropriate word to use, but it is what everyone uses. Some people have suggested we should call this collegiality, or it's your involvement in the university community, the academic community, outside of your research and so on. So, for the librarians, the academic duties are slightly different. So the main duty is position responsibilities, but then the other two are similar to the duties for the professoriate, so professional and scholarly activities and other contributions. Some responsibilities of yours, you must exercise due diligence. First of all, establishing to the satisfaction of the various committees that are going to consider your case that you have met the requirements for tenure, and putting together those aspects of the tenure dossier that you are responsible for. And these are, I would say, that are the most important aspects of the dossier. So the tenure criteria, the committees are going to be looking at how you've performed your academic duties. And here are the standards that are required. So you have to achieve a rating of superior in two of the three academic duties and at least reasonable in the third. In the case of librarians, they in fact must show superior in position responsibilities and in one other of the academic duties. It's very important to remember that for tenure, you have got to show strong, in fact, superior performance in your years leading up to tenure at McGill, and not just promise. Whereas for reappointment, promise also counts. But by the time you're being considered for tenure, we're looking for evidence of performance going back and not just promise going forward. And it's performance during your period as a tenure-track professor or librarian at McGill rather than performance before you came to McGill, unless you're going up for early tenure, in which case you can bring performance in a previous position into play. The other thing is that you are being considered across your whole record, all the years that you've been in your tenure track position, and all the things that you have done with respect to your academic duties. So just bear in mind that you can't, let's say it's clear to you and maybe your chair that you are more than superior in, let's say, teaching. but that you might not make a reasonable in, let's say, service, you can't move stuff over and say, I'm super in teaching, I want to count that towards one of my other academic duties. You can't do that. And the other thing you can't do, although in a way this relates to the overflow issue, you can't take certain achievements and try and count them in more than one category. But I would point out to you that you do have some flexibility. There are certain duties that you perform where, let's take advising of students as an example. That could be something that you might consider to be part of your teaching or part of your service. You can't count it as both, but you can choose which to count it as. So which part of your dossier needs a bit of boosting? If some of these more flexible things, you can choose where you want to report and talk about them. So now I'm going to talk a bit about the dossier. And this has to be submitted not later than September the 1st of your year of tenure consideration. It consists of a number of things: your CV, your personal statement, which covers your performance of academic duties, and then you sort of refer to the material that you will introduce that kind of expands on what you've said in your statement. So a record of your research, a record of your teaching, and Cynthia Weston will be telling you a bit more about what can go into that, and a record of your general contributions to the university and scholarly community. One thing I would urge you, and the temptation is to leave the preparation of your dossier till the summer before your tenure consideration year starts. Don't leave it that late. Build up your dossier as you go along. In any case, if you've already been reappointed, you will have done a sort of dossier for that, so build on that. Above all, for example, with your CV, update this all the time. Don't wait till year six to try and remember what it was that you did in year two. Keep it up to date all the time. It will save you a great deal of stress. You are also allowed to submit other materials in your dossier. So that's what goes in by September the 1st. Then there are additional items that get added to the dossier after September the 1st, most of them not by you. The external evaluator reports, which will have been received by the secretariat, it's the secretariat that adds those into your dossier, and you will not be seeing these except under exceptional circumstances. The chair of your departmental tenure committee may add material before November the 15th if he or she feels that there's extra information that needs to be in your dossier. And you may add material before November 15th. Typically, what tenure candidates add before November 15th is, for example, if your dossier said that a particular paper had been submitted to a journal and you hear between September 1st and November 15th that it's been accepted, then you will add material showing proof of acceptance. So it's usually rather minor additional information of that type. It's also possible after November 15th for any of the committees or the principal and or provost to ask you to supply additional material, so that gets added in after November 15th. The external examiners, their role is to provide an evaluation of your research and scholarship. They must be of recognized standing in your field, so qualified to evaluate you. They must not be at McGill. And they mustn't be in any kind of conflict of interest with you, so not your former supervisor, for example. And what we attempt to get is three independent evaluators. It's the Secretary General's office that solicits the evaluations. And only the Secretary General and his office may communicate with the evaluators. And no one may approach other evaluators. So tenure candidates sometimes think, well, can I ask a few other people to write similar letters for me? And the answer is no. Or if you do it, the committees will not consider these letters. It's the ones that are, and we'll in a moment come to how the official evaluators are chosen, but you can't add other people. The only exception where it isn't the Secretary General that needs to communicate with the evaluators is if the University Tenure Committee feels that the three letters that came in did not give them enough evidence. They can actually approach other evaluators, provided those are people on the list that's been previously agreed between you and your chair, and I'll get to that in a moment. So, as has already been mentioned by the Provost, we've got three levels of review: the Departmental Tenure Committee, the University Tenure Committee, which is at the faculty level, and the Principal and her delegate, the Provost. So, just to tell you a little bit about the committee composition, the chair of the DTC is normally the head of your academic unit, so chair or director. There are four members in addition to the chair. All committee members must be tenured, and no individual can serve on your DTC and your UTC. So each committee is a different set of people. When you get to the University Tenure Committee, the chair is normally the dean of the faculty. There are six members, that's including the dean, so five in addition to the dean. And of these five people, two are chosen from the so-called faculty list, so they're going to be people in your faculty but not in your department. And then three are chosen from the so-called Senate list, and these will be people from other faculties. And again, no UTC member can be from your department. In the case of joint appointments, this is really just to say that all these things there has to be joint consultation between your chairs and your deans to make sure that both units are represented on the committees that are considering you. Obviously, what we're looking for from our committees is objectiveness, impartiality, and fairness. They are assessing you on the basis of your academic duties, your performance of those, and on the basis of your record that's in front of them. So basically, what is in your dossier, either put there by you or added by other people. And the two committees, the DTC and the UTC, must provide a report giving reasons for their assessment of your performance. And you will see those reports during the process. So the kinds of recommendations that committees can make. I think the most typical recommendation is unanimous, so all members of the committee agree. However, in some cases, for some candidates, there may be a majority decision, let's say, in favor of a candidate, and perhaps one or more minority decisions against, or vice versa. And where that happens, where the decision is not unanimous, nevertheless, all the reports, the majority and the minority ones, the decisions and everything, have to be seen by the whole committee and submitted at the same time. In other words, no committee member, after the process is over, after the DTC level is over or the UTC level is over, can sort of say, oh, I meant to say such and such about that candidate and try to submit something after the fact. That is not allowed. So all committee members have to sign all support reports, and once those reports are in, that's that committee's work done. So I'm going to talk now about the tenure timetable, and I'm going to divide it into three sections. Phase one is the phase that you have most control over. Well, there are certain deadlines, but it's where you are sort of finalizing certain things. So if you, for example, you're thinking of early tenure consideration, by the middle of April, you must let your chair and dean know that that's what you'd like to do. And then the dean has to let the secretary general know in early May the names of all tenure candidates, including early, coming up from that faculty. And here's the one thing where, again, you have a very important role. That is to say, you and your chair must agree on a list of 8 potential external evaluators. As I've said, we only use 3 of them. But you have you will often know who suitable people are in your field. You will often know who unsuitable people are. So this is a very important process that you engage in. If you are intending to defer tenure consideration because of a previous leave, you must let us know this by June the 1st. And then by June 15th, you are going to submit your current CV to your chair. This doesn't mean that you can't change it afterwards. You can. And then the chair is going to send your CV and the list of 8 to the dean so that the university tenure committee can start making the choice of, out of the 8, the tenure committee will rank them in terms of who the Secretary General should be approaching to serve as your external evaluator. And then by September the 1st, you will be informed of the composition of both your committees, and you will submit to the Secretary General's office your dossier. And this is where, so we're now doing this electronically, and this is where this piece of paper that you've received is very important, excuse me, because it tells you exactly how to do this. And in a sense, after phase one, your role is not completely over, but certainly other people are now, it's the process that involves other people. In particular, in what I'm calling phase two, September to January, your departmental tenure committee is meeting, probably several times. They decide themselves what the dates will be. So in early September, they receive your dossier from the secretariat, and also your externals are receiving the external version of your dossier. And then by November 15th, I've already mentioned, this is the deadline for adding any extra material to the dossier. You should note that anything that's added between September 1st and November 15th doesn't go to your external evaluators, but only to the internal committees. After November 15th, you may, but probably won't, be asked to add additional material. And by November 25th, the external evaluator reports are made available to the two committees that are considering you. And then we're moving into phase three, which is the university tenure committee. So by January, the departmental tenure committee has finished considering you. And by January the 25th, they have submitted their report, and you will get a copy of the report at that point. Again, the UTC may ask for extra information. They usually don't. And they have until April the 30th to have their meetings and submit their report. And when they submit their report, you will also get a copy. In May and June, your dossiers are considered by the principal and or provost. For many years, it's been principal and provost here. A decision is reached and a recommendation made to the Board of Governors. But if you are tending to a negative, you will be, if the principal or provost is intending to a negative in your case, you will hear about this in May. So let me just tell you a bit about tending to the negative. This will not happen to most of you. It might happen to none of you. At any level, DTC, UTC, or principal and provost, if they're tending to a negative, there are various things that happen. First of all, you are advised in writing. So you receive in writing the concerns that the committee has with your performance of academic duties. You are, in these circumstances, allowed to see the external evaluator reports, but with their names removed. You're given reasonable time to prepare a response. What is reasonable time? We've decided 2 weeks is a working definition. And you are given the opportunity to address the concerns of the committee or the principal or provost in person, accompanied by an advisor. And I would strongly recommend, if this does happen to you, that you take advantage of that opportunity. Because, well, first of all, most of you won't be tending to a negative, but if this happens to you, in many situations, when the candidate meets with the committee that's tending to the negative, they are, in fact, able to address the committee's concerns such that the committee then makes a positive recommendation. So it's worth taking advantage of the opportunity of convincing the committee that their judgment of you was mistaken in some way. So if the outcome is positive, you'll be informed by the end of May or early June, but actually quite often you don't get the official letter until sometime in June after the board has met. So let's put it this way. If you've heard nothing by the end of May, then things are good for you. No news is good news in this situation. If you aren't recommended for tenure, that is to say, if the DTC, UTC, principal and provost, or if the principal has accepted a recommendation that you should not be granted tenure, then your appointment will continue or be renewed for up to 1 year, and there is an appeal process which the provost has mentioned, which I won't go over here. So just to wind up, this may seem to be intimidating, but don't let yourselves be intimidated. You can do a lot to make it easier by planning ahead. I mentioned the CV issue as one example. So in general, don't wait till the last minute to start putting stuff together. It is very, very stressful if you only left yourself a month or two in the last summer. Above all, don't be afraid to ask advice all the way through. Ask your chair, ask your colleagues who've recently gone through tenure, and ask me. Okay, so my email is there. These slides will be posted on the Secretariat webpage. But if you have any questions about interpreting any aspect of the regulations, email me. Usually after this meeting every year, I get half a dozen emails right away and then some later. But that's what I'm here for, to give you any assistance I can with the tenure process. So now I'm going to turn things over to Cynthia Weston, who will talk a little bit about the teaching portfolio, and then we'll have questions about anything that anybody has said today.
As Lydia and and the others have mentioned the teaching portfolio is a required component of the tenure dossier. And as academics, we're more accustomed to documenting our research than we are our teaching, putting together a list of publications or conference presentations. So really the purpose of this brief presentation is to help you think through and provide some guidelines for how we can collect artifacts and document our teaching in the way that we also document our research. The Appendix A is, when you go online and you find the regulations, Appendix A is on page 20 and 21 of the regulations, just at the very end of that section. And there's a brief definition of what the teaching dossier or the teaching portfolio is supposed to do. And I really want to emphasize the word concise because, and Lydia's laughing, because we've had many comments, people would put together way too much stuff, and these documents would become too much to review. So we really want it to be concise. In a minute, I'll tell you about page limits. And you really want to document the scope of your teaching, your individuality. Just as you have individuality in your research, you have individuality in your teaching. And you really want to capture that and represent it. Here's the structure. Very simple, straightforward structure. There's the teaching portfolio is a maximum of 20 pages. Better if it's 15. Less is always better in the case of people who are reading hundreds of dossiers. The body of the teaching portfolio has four components. First of all, and I'm going to describe each one of these very briefly for you in a moment. And that's about 5 to 10 pages. And then appendices, and you want to be really selective about your appendices. It's only something you've already referred to in the body of your text. So let me go through each one of these very briefly. The teaching approach. How and why do you teach the way you do? This is that individuality of your teaching. What strategies are you using, and why are you using them? How are you assessing learning? And sometimes we haven't thought about these things. So everybody's been saying collect your documents, work on your dossier in advance. This is really something you want to start to, you know, just do a brain dump, get some ideas out there, and revise it over time. Most profs say they continue to revise it annually because their thinking continues to evolve. So it'll also help you to be a little bit more intentional, probably, about what it is that you're doing and why you're doing it. And then a really important piece now at McGill is that undergraduates benefit from the research-intensive nature of this institution. So we're really encouraging professors to consider whether, particularly those at the undergraduate level, because, of course, at the graduate level, we're all involved in research and the students are involved in research, but how at the undergraduate level can you bring some of that research nature of the institution, some of the process of inquiry into your undergraduate teaching? So that's really something to think about, and to certainly you can call me if you want to talk some more about that. It's something that we're looking for increasingly in teaching dossiers and for teaching awards. And that's 1 to 2 pages, meaning front side, back side, that's it. Teaching responsibilities. This is probably the piece that's easiest for you to document, but again, you don't want to wait till the 6th year to do it. You want to keep track of all those courses you're teaching, what size they are. If you're in a clinical setting, how many of you are in a clinical setting? Okay, sometimes it's a little tougher to document those, so we can talk about that if you want, but you want to try to gather together all those different lectures you're giving in all those different courses, what the time commitment of that is. And supervision is teaching. Sometimes we think of it as research. It is teaching. So make sure you keep track of all your graduates and your undergraduates and your postdoc and the theses and the internships and the special projects that you're supervising, and even student advising. Third component that you want to talk about is the evidence of effectiveness. As you know, course evaluations are mandatory at McGill. Probably you've all gotten your course evaluation results through Mercury. You want to keep track of those, but you do not put in all of your course evaluations. Your task, and this is that due diligence piece that we've been talking about, is to summarize that and interpret that for the committee. Remember, they've got a lot of different things to read, so you want to tell them what's been the pattern, what's been the trajectory. Maybe you had some trouble at the beginning and you've gotten a lot better. Talk about, you know, show that and then talk a little bit about it. That's the interpretation piece of your course evaluation. So usually people present a table And then they give a little bit of a description or an explanation of what it is that they see there and how that provides evidence of the effectiveness of their teaching. Also, you want to capture evidence of supervision, of your graduate supervision, even undergraduate supervision. A lot of times for graduate supervision, that means whether they've, the external reports they've gotten on their theses, where they've been placed after they've graduated. Those are some of the things that we can think about in terms of graduate supervision. We can talk more about that if you wish. And the final component, which is optional, if applicable, because you're thinking it's not so much at the reappointment process, but at the tenure process, it is something that we'd like you to think about, is what are you doing in terms of developing your teaching and educational leadership? A lot of you probably sit on curriculum committees or program committees in your faculties, in your departments. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about, advising and mentoring colleagues, working with TAs. If there are teaching innovations, which is something that we're really working at McGill, that you're experimenting with in your teaching, those are the kinds of things that you can include there. So we do provide individual consultations at Teaching and Learning Services. We're on the main floor of the McLennan Library Building. And here's 4919 you can call, or you can look for us at TLS on the web. We'll work with you on interpretation of course evaluations. We can help you develop or give feedback on your teaching portfolio. We have samples from across disciplines for you to review. And I believe all these are going to be uploaded on the web, are they? Great. So this information will be available for you. Any questions?
Or another of the portfolios, so you have to be careful. You choose where it goes. Right.
Thank you. Maybe related to that, I have two questions. First one, thesis evaluations, serving on as external examiner and is it teaching? Is it service?
The issue of where it belongs is what we just were talking about. So you'll have to make a decision, and usually you put it where you think you need the most help. So you get to choose compiling your dossier, but no overflows, no double counting. Lydia was very clear about that. And in this, the teaching dossier, however, the interesting thing about the teaching dossier is not just teaching evaluations. It's the developmental activities in which you've engaged, your philosophy about teaching, and how you've executed it. So you make a decision where that is. Is it service or is it addition to teaching? You can choose where to put it.
If I could have another question. And with respect to the teaching, I've realized often in my department they compare the averages, the average to an answer to the average of the courses. Yet the courses are anything, the average that is reported is anything between 200 level and 600 level courses or 700 level courses, which obviously if I look at my own pattern, I get much better averages at the graduate level than I get at 200 level. Then it's a bit skewed. How do you deal with that?
Actually, we are able now to break down course evaluations by size of class. So you can ask for a departmental average on all other classes or a university average on all other classes of the size that you're teaching. So that gives you a fair comparator. So you don't have to just use the departmental average that goes from 5 to 600.
Also, you can, in your teaching portfolio, make that point, right, that it depends on the size and the level and that you are... everybody recognizes that teaching large classes is likely to lower your ratings. So just be upfront about it. You know, don't avoid discussing, but just point out to the committee this class was 600 students or whatever. I mean, you know, tackle these things head on rather than hoping that nobody will notice if your ratings are low for a particular type of student.
Can you comment on the appropriateness or the benefit of using letters from students for the teaching dossier and from international research collaborators on your contributions to research?
Well, let me start with the second one. On the whole, we do not want your dossiers packed with letters of support from other people. So with respect to research. So really only if it is a sort of an essential way of backing up some claim that you've made in your statement, then you could include them. But we have seen dossiers that have got, you know, this fat, letters attesting to this, that, and the other. Try and avoid that. Now, as to letters from students, this one's a bit harder to decide, because especially for graduate students, this is maybe one of the best ways of demonstrating that you have been a superior supervisor. And yet, on the other hand, the committees are sometimes a bit uneasy about the fact that, you know, have you solicited these or have they come in spontaneously? If you've solicited these, have your students felt unable to say no? So I think, so the answer is you can do this, but you need to exercise some caution. And I know in some departments, in my department, for example, sometimes the chair does the soliciting on behalf of the tenure candidate so that students can feel free to say, no, actually, I don't want to say anything. And that's probably a better way of proceeding, because then the committee is comfortable with the fact that the student wasn't under any pressure from a particular professor to do this.
And they should be former students.
Yes, that's right. You should not be pressuring. You should not be asking current students.
Just to clarify one other thing, the importance of the external letters is taken very seriously by both the DTC and the UTC, as well as by the provost and principal in the assessment. So you really want to make sure you've chosen, in the list of eight, appropriate individuals. The chair of the departmental tenure committee, and some of you are here now, plays a very important role in screening that list. We have had cases in the last couple of years in which that screening was not done appropriately by the departmental tenure committee, wasn't done appropriately by the university tenure committee, who approved the list and ranked them. Solicitations have gone out for individuals to send letters, and we've caught them at the level of the review of the principal and the provost, that the person who is writing the letter has a recent research grant or is published with the individual, isn't him or herself already tenured at another university or holding a rank of equivalent status. This is not acceptable. Then we have to go back and ask for additional letters. That's why Lydia said we can ask for additional information at the UTC or the principal provost level if the information coming forward isn't appropriate. So you really have to do a good job in making sure that the people, the eight people on the list that you've submitted for external letters, in fact meet all of the criteria: arm's length relationship, themselves holding tenure or its equivalent, and being able to comment objectively on the candidate's dossier.
I'd like to add something about letters that you didn't mention, and that is with respect to the service component. If you have served on a committee that is really heavy duty, it does help to have the chair of that committee write in to the departmental tenure committee, or write to you as part of your dossier to say, this wasn't just a committee where the person sat and did nothing and we only met once a term. So, you know, sometimes for the service component, it's helpful to the committee to be told what the committee work that you were involved in actually involves.
Yeah, so I had a question about the external evaluators. And my first question would be whether or not they need to have a particular composition in terms of Canadian faculty, international faculty, European faculty. And second of all, I'm a little bit unclear as to what constitutes a close personal relationship. And maybe you could clarify some cases where it's clearly too close. If I've invited someone to give a seminar at McGill, if I've been invited, if I've had dinner with them at conferences, at what point does a close personal relationship become too much?
To answer your first question first, the main criterion for choosing an external is that they are an expert in their field and your field who's suitable to assess you. And it doesn't matter whether they're Canadian or international, and it doesn't matter if it's international, whether it's the USA or anywhere else in the world. So don't feel that you've got to somehow pack your list with a mixture of, just choose the most suitable people. Your second question is much harder to answer, and often I get emails or calls from people asking me whether a particular situation forms a conflict. But the examples you gave would not. I mean, if you meet somebody at a conference and you have a meal with them, that's not a conflict. If you invite them to give a talk, that's not a conflict. But are you collaborating? Have you collaborated? Are you thinking of collaborating and you've begun to talk about collaboration? That would be a conflict. But if in doubt, please feel free to get in touch with me and I'll talk through various situations.
I don't know. Just one other thing for the departmental chairs and the individuals who are soliciting or want to put people on a list of names to be considered. You want to consider McGill is a research-intensive university that has a certain status in the world, and we do like the letters to come from peer institutions where possible. But sometimes departments in non-peer institutions are quite strong, and they have scholars of renown and note, and therefore you should just make that case when you select someone who's not from a U15 or an AAU or one of the major European or Asian universities. So you would say, this is a smaller department, but it has a very strong reputation in my field. I don't know the person, or I've have an arm's-length relationship, as Lydia just described. But you should make that case very clear, and the form requires that you list any of those kinds of conflicts, which would allow us to make a determination as to whether or not there is a conflict or a potential conflict of interest. Disclosure is the best strategy, so in the cases in which you have doubt.
And one problem for those of you who come from relatively small fields, this is sometimes very hard because you end up meeting the same people over and over at the same conferences. So again, feel free to consult me in advance, or as Tony says, declare what might be a conflict on the form, and then the UTC will decide whether they want to include that person or not.
I understand Senate has begun deliberating changing the requirements for tenure, I think emphasizing research. I understand this is an ongoing deliberation and there might be continued progress this year. So just want to ask if any changes do occur in the near future, will that be salient for the upcoming cohort?
In general, you can't change things after a person has already arrived or been through the stream, right? So if you're in a tenure stream now on a basis of a set of expectations that existed, the rules would only apply to those who come later. Now, we generally let people make a choice if they'd like to opt into a new system, even if they weren't in that stream, but we never hold them accountable backwards for what's happened. Does that answer your question?
But can I make it clear that we have not? So there was a discussion in Senate in April or May, and the issue that was discussed was, should McGill, instead of having a requirement for two superiors out of the three academic duties, have a requirement for two superiors, but they have to be in research and teaching? There was an interesting discussion in Senate, and as a result of that, we decided we're not ready yet to officially make that move without further discussion across the university. So there's ongoing discussion. It's not clear that this will even come back to Senate this year as an issue, But if any of you have opinions about this, we would like to hear them. So, you know, this is very much an issue that is of interest and concern to everyone, but it will not affect you. Nothing is going to happen right now.
Thank you. In some universities, candidates are allowed to see a sanitized version of the external report. Can we do this, McGill?
No, only if they're tending, if the decision is tending to the negative. Then candidates get to see, but otherwise not. Although, do they get them? Can they get them at the end? No. No. So
even a sanitized version in which you eliminate anything that could identify the...
No. Well, even if it's tending to the negative, the version is sanitized to remove identifying information. But no, if your externals have been nice and positive about you and the committees feel you're wonderful, you don't get to see what the externals said.
Thanks. Okay, so I had two questions. One of them had to do with the order of preference of externals and how that is set up, because the only experience I have is sending a list of graduate studies for a doctoral student and saying these are the external examiners or for masters, and then graduate studies does their own ranking, which isn't necessarily the one that we thought was ideal. So I don't know how that happens here. The second question had to do with joint appointments, because I'm jointly appointed. Academic culture, departmental culture, faculty culture varies among different faculty, so they may have different impressions about different parts of a dossier. What if the disciplines break down differently in the final decision? So say one of your two faculties, or the representatives of one of the faculty, are very positive or very positive on some areas and not others, and the other ones are not. How is that handled?
I'll answer your first question first. So I'll just tell you that in graduate studies, although they're not doing that anymore, I mean, they're not, the whole process has changed. It wasn't a ranking. They just picked a name randomly. Okay, so that is not what's happening here. And it is the University Tenure Committee who receives the eight names that you and your chair have submitted. And the assumption is that you haven't submitted them in a ranked order, or if you have, that's going to be ignored. The University Tenure Committee looks at the suggestions and will have certain criteria in mind that make them determine the ranking, such as what is the rank of the institution that the person comes from? Are they a full professor or are they associate professor? All sorts of things like that. But it's the UTC that does the ranking.
You should make sure that when you have agreed on the eight names, it should almost be indifferent to you in which order we approach them. Because we may approach them 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, 3 say, can't do it now. We have to go to 4, 5, 6. So you should feel that the eight names are reflect appropriately your discipline and the ability to judge you. We will use the rank order. The Secretary General will use the rank order that's given to the Secretariat by the Dean, who chairs the University Tenure Committee. But we don't have any guarantee that that is the order that will in fact be reflected. We might get 1, 6, and 8. So we need 8 to solicit to make sure that in the timetable that we have available, we get 3 recommendations. So make sure you're comfortable in your discussion with the dean of your faculty, or in this case, jointly with the two deans, if it's across different faculties, that you have 8 people who you feel can judge your dossier appropriately, and don't worry about the rank order. That rank order is done by the University Tenure Committee.
About your second question about joint appointments, this is interesting, and I'm not aware of this problem having arisen so far. But you're right, it could. And, you know, this is why it is essential that in the case of joint appointments, both of the units are represented, and in fact represented equally, at both the level of the DTC and the UTC. I can't tell you what would happen if there was kind of disagreement down the middle at the DTC level. Now, at the UTC level, bear in mind that three of the committee members are appointed from the Senate list by the Secretariat. So these are going to be people who actually should be able to, in a position to be able to stand back and look at any disagreement across the two units. So, and then, of course, the provost and the principal can do the same. So, but if anyone has concern in advance that this might happen to you in a joint appointment, I suggest you talk to somebody now as opposed to waiting till it's time to submit your dossier and then wondering whether your different disciplines are going to disagree strongly about how to assess you.
I have two questions as well. The first is a follow-up to the last one. In the case of joint appointments or dual appointments, I know that we won't be notified of the actual members of the committee until we've submitted our dossier. Is it possible to know of the numbers of the committee, whether it will be split down the middle, where the chair will be from, and so forth? Because it'll make a difference in the way you write your tenure dossier, given which disciplines are more heavily represented or not.
We're aiming to have them equally represented, so that and I think the answer to your question is no.
Okay. Because the
decision as to committee membership is only made in the summer before you submit the dossier, and as I've already been saying, I would suggest you don't wait till that summer to write the dossier. So you will not get. Yeah, you really won't get the composition, even without the names, until early September.
It's really important that when we make a joint appointment, we've made a joint appointment. And I think there isn't a primary, except for purposes of bookkeeping on a salary. There is no primary. There shouldn't be a primary and a secondary. So it's not like being an associate member in another department, which doesn't have a say in whether or not you get tenure. A joint appointment is in two departments, and the criteria should be made clear as you're appointed as to what the expectations are. I don't think you need to tailor, I hope, on the basis of who's the audience, because your tenure criteria will have to be assessed also at the university level, not just the department level, and then at the level of the principal and the provost. And we're looking at it as a joint appointment, equally appointed in two departments.
My second question is, can you elaborate on what the refusal for university priorities is, and if what these priorities could be, and if this has happened? Is it something we should even be concerned about?
No, I don't think any of you should be concerned about it. It's never happened in Canada.
Okay.
In the United States, there have been cases in which departments have been, for a truly bona fide financial exigency, have been eliminated, and tenure has generally been interpreted in those cases as in the department, not in the faculty or at the university. But we've never had a case in which we've, even when we have had units merged, we've not had the problem where that has happened. Now, I said it because I think it's important that you say, look, there are three exceptional circumstances under which someone may lose their tenure at a university, one of which is a true financial exigency. If the government turned around tomorrow and said the grant for McGill is cut by 50%, we wouldn't be able to pay your salary. So that would be the only real possibility. It's not. It's remote, but I felt in the fairness of full disclosure, you should know about it.
Course evaluations are numbers, and the variance and the mean of those numbers seems to be reduced in courses which the students see as harder or having harder grading standards applied to them. Is this going to hurt me? Thanks.
So you're thinking that the variance on your particular course evaluations or the means of your particular course evaluations might...
I'm actually, yeah.
I don't think so. I actually don't. I mean, I so I have my own experience. And a long time ago, I taught statistics to many unwilling students in the social sciences.
My students don't understand statistics.
In a required course, so I understand where you're coming from. But I don't think that that's really the major concern. And there is, as we've said, we can do it by whether the course is large or small. We can actually do it by whether the course is required or not. And we do know that certain types of material, we have unwilling participants, but the department and or the university have decided that this is an appropriate thing for someone to study. So we could take those things into consideration. I don't think you'd be penalized for that. The other thing to remember is in your statement of what you're teaching and why and how, you can make this case. I teach a course on statistics to students who have to take it, who don't have appropriate backgrounds usually, and I have a philosophy that says X, Y, Z. The course evaluations or the professorial evaluations are not the only thing that go into the teaching dossier. It's your contribution to the curricular development of your department. The fact that you're teaching a required course is itself a contribution that needs to be emphasized. So I would not worry about whether your course evaluations are being hurt by the fact that it's a material that's difficult and required and et cetera. So just point that out.
I want to add something to that, which is, in many cases, your department will know exactly what the issue is, the problem, if it's a course that the students hate but have to do and so on. And certainly when I was chair of a department, when we were going through a departmental tenure committee, we would often put this in the report. We recognize that this person has been teaching a particular course that the students find very difficult. And consequently, the course evaluations are perhaps lower than they might be in other circumstances. And then the DTC actually sort of gives an explanation. So I think, you know, again, I think this is something not to worry about too much. But as Tony said, make sure you describe it in your statement. And then the DTC can add to this and say, yes, we agree. That is the reason why the evaluations were like this.
The reason that the teaching portfolio was brought in at McGill was to go beyond the numbers of course evaluations. And the reason I was hesitating was because I was trying to think of the best way of communicating to you. I mean, that is one piece of the whole dossier, which I think has already been stated here. And talking about the challenges is part of that interpretation part of the summary and interpretation of your course evaluation numbers. So again, that's been said here, but I think, you know, that's the opportunity to say it's been a challenging course, or it's a challenging group of students, or look, you know, I remember one person who's been presenting at a number of sessions who at the beginning really struggled and had tough comments from the course evaluations as well. And then she showed, like 5 years later, she'd worked on it, she'd tried to respond to it, and how things had changed. So it actually can, you know, and it's something you can work with.
Cynthia raised an interesting point, and one that we've seen before. Some people selectively choose the positive qualitative assessments that they get to balance some of the negatives that might be in the quantitative assessment. But if you put only a partial list in, since your chair is also privy to all of those comments, he or she may choose to put the negative ones in. So you have to be careful about how you've decided what goes into the selective choice of the evaluations. They're only a part. They're not the whole assessment in the teaching dossier. So I don't think you should worry about that.
My follow-up, and I don't want to talk too much about myself, but I don't like the evaluation questions that the students are given. I don't think that they are well-phrased in order to reveal what's actually happening in the course. So I did a follow-up survey of my own. Can I include that kind of information?
Absolutely, you can include that. In fact, we're encouraging professors to do surveys on their own, and we can help you with that halfway through the course, because then you can actually do something about it, number one. Number two, your department or your faculty chooses the questions that go into the course evaluation. We have a recommended set, but it's something that you can talk about with the department or faculty. You can raise. We can talk with them about it and work with them. You know, there are a lot of opportunities, but you might look at the recommended pool in relation to the ones that are used in your department and come forward with some suggestions about what might better represent.
I just want to be careful. I don't want to give you fault, because if it's good, the formative part, which is what Cynthia is talking about, is great in the middle of a course, et cetera. But if you're doing an additional course evaluation at the end, we have no way of validating that. So I don't think it's a good idea to include it, except to you could state that you've used a formative, that's in your teaching philosophy. I use a formative questionnaire to help me do things better. And you should definitely talk to your chair and your dean about the kinds of questions that go into the evaluations that then we use to assess all of the candidates. So we do try to use a standardization when we're looking at the teaching evaluation component of the course evaluations for the teaching dossier. And if we have unstandard, non-standard information, it makes that much harder as you go up the level.
One more thing. There are 4 standard questions that are on all course evaluations across the university. And those are the ones that they've been very carefully analyzed, and they're very stable across disciplines and so on. So those are the ones that people often tend to look at, and some of the ones that vary so widely or that are created by a department or by a faculty, you know, may not carry as much weight in any case as those 4 cores.
I just have a question about the level of documentation on the research appendix that you are expecting. If I've given a seminar at a university, do I need to include a poster that advertised my talk? If I've been given a grant, do I have to provide the, you know, what level of documentation do you want for
we
these
We don't
kinds
want
of
that. you will put on your CV that you have given a presentation somewhere and that you've got a research grant. And we will trust you. We do not need the proof. The only time where we might want proof is if you say on your CV that a paper has been accepted. Then it would be good to include the letter from the journal or the editor or the email that says, you know. So, yeah, don't feel you've got to stack your dossier with a lot of paper backing it up. But so what should be in the research component, I mean, is certainly a summary in your individual statement, you know, a discussion of what your research is, how it fits into your field, what your contributions have been, and then your CV is presumably going to list all your publications and presentations, and you can include a sample of publications. Please do not give us PDFs of every paper you have ever written. But, you know, a sample that can be used to back up the claims that you have made in your statement about your own research. So be selective here. If you're in arts or humanities in general, and you actually need to include a book, speak to Bonnie Bornstein about how that's going to be handled. In other words, if you want the external evaluators to read a book that you've written, this is rather more complicated than having PDFs of your papers. But unless it's an e-book, of course. So more rather than less in terms of documentation.
Of course, we trust that people are fair and honest in their own assessment of themselves and do not provide false information to us, just to be really clear. Were it to come forward after you were granted tenure that there was a false information in your dossier, that would be cause number one for denying you tenure. So just make sure you do it honestly and fairly.
I have a quick question about interdepartmental, faculty teaching and services. So, for example, my primary appointment, my only appointment is in the clinical hospital division, but I do undergraduate teaching for Faculty of Science. How is that looked at as far as service, and does it matter where you do it at the end of the day?
Again, it's going to be up to you to decide, is that going to be service or is it going to be teaching? It's certainly going to be considered part of your overall performance of academic duties. So you should definitely mention it, talk about it. But where you put it is, sometimes if you're not sure where to put things, talk to your chair or director. What do they think? So in this case where the teaching is sort of totally outside your unit, clearly there is a service function there, but talk to your chair or director about the best place to put it, but you definitely should put it somewhere.
In the case of tending towards a negative
the candidate receives a copy of the report and the anonymized external evaluators reports. In the case of a DTC recommending tenure, but there's a minority report, do the candidates receive copies of the minority reports? And if so, are they anonymized?
They do receive, and they aren't anonymized. And, I mean, we've had some discussion about this, but there's nothing in the regulations right. that says they should be anonymized, and there's everything in the regulations that says, never mind with their negative, the positive and the negative decisions, that all candidates get those reports with the names attached. No, no, not the externals. The externals are anonymized.
It's the internal minority report
from the DTC. Anonymous.
So no. if someone has written a letter on their own letterhead as a minority report,
it's member not of the anonymized. No.
The candidate will get a copy of that.
The candidate must get those.
Yes.
If there's a pending to negative. The fact is, a minority report doesn't necessarily mean the committee has recommended or is tending to a negative.
No, right. If a committee is tending towards a positive, is recommending, however, there was a minority report, because there's a section on that report that says, is this unanimous,
yeah.
and is there a minority report, and you have to declare if there's a minority report, and then provide it.
Right.
And that's what I wanted to know.
So it's worth, if you are chairing a DTC, it's worth pointing out to professors who are going to write minority reports that these are not public, but these are available to the candidate, non-anonymized. They may want to adjust exactly.
But there's nowhere in the regulations that makes that clear. There's nowhere in the regulations where that's stated up front or where it's made clear
no.
as part of the process.
Everyone, as Lydia pointed out, everyone on a committee must sign every document. So even if you are submitting a minority report, you sign the majority report and say you disagree with it. So everyone's signature is there, everyone who's on the committee is there, and everyone who has a minority report, the other committee members have to have seen it as well. It's not, so those go forward, and you're serving the university internally, you're known, and that report is part of the record.
So then if I could comment to say that that has de facto shut down all individual reports and minority reports in our committee because it created acrimony, unexpected acrimony. So it seemed anomalous to us that you would anonymize external reports where the individual has no relationship with the individual, and yet you have colleagues internally with whom the person does have a relationship, and we're asking them to be very honest, and, you know, the consequences are obvious. You know?
I'm not so sure that that consequence has to be that obvious, and again, it's a question. If it's happening, we're sorry that it is, because one of the most important things in any collegial relationship is the ability to be honest. And if you can't be honest with the people who you're assessing, if you're afraid of your opinions, then you probably shouldn't express them. Honestly, I mean that. You should be willing to say what you believe. And a colleague, if that person then eventually gets tenure, will work that out. It should not be acrimonious. It should be about the assessment in an honest and forthright way. This is what I think as a person writing this minority report. Or this is what I think signing the majority report. I agree with what's written here. So I think it's very important to have that conversation. And I'd be glad to come to your department and tell them what I think about being willing to write what they believe.
They might still not agree.
Understood. But I'd at least like to have the opportunity to do that. Any other questions, comments?
I have a tiny question. So I've been told by senior people in my department that people who wrote a reference letter for me when I applied for the job can't serve as external evaluators for tenure. Is that right?
I think that's probably true, because this means they know you in a certain capacity.
What if this person doesn't know me? He's only written a letter for me once.
Seems an odd choice of a letter.
He knows my work.
I think this is the kind of case where, you know, why don't you talk to me about such situations? But as a rule of thumb, I would say you probably shouldn't be using people who've written who've written letters for you for this job, but you, then the question is, what about they've written letters for something else, like you're applying for a fellowship of some kind? Well, then maybe that's okay. Each of these, I think, has to be considered on a case-by-case basis.
Enough time, probably.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
These 5 years, you haven't had any more contact, yeah. You're not writing papers or grants together, yeah. Then you declare that this person did that, let an assessment be made. So it's not that you absolutely can't use them, but it's better to, again, full disclosure is best. If there are no other questions, then thank you very much.